Hi, everybody. My name is Vinoy Shaw, and I'm a member of Al-Anon.
Hi,
y'all. I always have to say, they always introduce me from Los Angeles, and I'm really from Texas. It just seems like it's important that y'all need that. And I love this hotel because it reminds me of home. I want to thank the committee for asking me. It's always a true honor and a real pleasure to come and share my story anywhere. And thank you for the great basket. It was beautiful. It's this lime green basket and has all these red and yellow pieces of fruit in it. It's just gorgeous. It looks so springtime. It's the only spring thing I've seen since I've been here. I was just so happy to come back where it's springtime and, you know, see it, and looks just like home. And a special thank you to Pam. She has called, and, you know, some places you go, you don't know if they know you're even coming. And she's been very gracious and a wonderful hostess. And Ron, thank you for hauling my luggage back and forth. And I appreciate you, all of you, making me feel at home. And my two little dummies came down from Des Moines. They called and said they'd be here between 8 and 9. And I said, well, I expect them about 10 or 11. And sure enough, they got here at 10 to 11. And they're a great support. And I thank both of you for driving that way to be with me. Well, I'll tell you, my head's so full of stuff that I'm not sure if I can remember my story. I was so impressed with was that a lecture? I'm really not sure. It was informative, but is that a professional lecture that you just did? Half and half? I was very, very impressed. I've not heard that before. I've heard of it, but it's my first time to sit and listen to it. And I don't mean to be disrespectful at all, ever. And if I offend any of you alcoholics, please, I'm just having a good time. I learned a long time, you know, give it up, give it a light touch. But, you know, they spent all that money studying all those rats, and hell, we just lived with them, you know? Telling the same thing wouldn't cost nothing. I love alcoholics. I just love them. I've had three major ones and a bunch of minor ones in between, and may go hunt down another one. I don't know. My sponsor said that I was kind of like a squirrel looking for a tree to climb up my whole life, and you cannot say that any alcoholic came into my life and, you know, made it poor and pitiful, because I went and, you know, hunted them down just like a hunting dog. I just love alcoholics, and so that I wouldn't ever be too far from one, I had two of my own. So they're part of my life, and the disease has affected me. The disease of alcoholism has affected me and my children, and the disease of Al-Anon has affected me and my children, and I'm right where I'm supposed to be, right in the middle of this fellowship. So I'm delighted to be here. I came into this program February the 7th of 1969 in Lubbock, Texas. My home group was the Central Group for many, many years, where I grew up. My home group now is the Stepped Up Group in L.A. We meet Mondays and Thursday nights, and my committed home group AA meeting is the Pacific Group, which meets on Wednesday night. If you're ever in L.A., I will take you to any of the above, and that's just not idle talk. I mean it. I'm extremely pleased with my recovery out there. They're great people. You know, there's just so much to tell. I mean, you just kind of wonder where to start and where to get in the middle and where to end. It's just so much. It just, life keeps happening, is what all the speakers have said, and they've just all been glorious. And the ones to come, I know, are glorious. And life just happens, and there's just so much, and it's great. I'm from Texas. I had a mom and dad. My dad was part Indian from Oklahoma. My mama came from a divorced family, which was not done back in those days. And they were always felt less than. They had us kids. I had three brothers and me, and they try to put a little family together, and they're just hardworking, good Southern Baptist folks, and try to teach us to be good Southern Baptist kids, and none of it took on any of us. My oldest brother broke his neck when I was a little girl, a little young thing, in a swimming accident on vacation, and for several years I was kind of farmed out. It sounds a little bit tougher than what it was, but different people kept me because my parents were in hospitals with my brother. This happened in Oklahoma, so he was there for quite some time, and they transferred him to Dallas, and so they had to be with him, one or the other, and Daddy couldn't take care of all of us, and the boys pretty much stayed with that, and I was with family and friends. So I was always kind of out of place, and started real young feeling out of place and not belonging, and just being quiet over in the corner and not bothering anybody. Hard to tell that nowadays, but that's really and truly the way I came up. I got into high school and started running around with the older women. You know, those are in seniors, and they took me to the most magnificent place. And this is why I say about this hotel, it kind of reminds me of it. Low rooms, you know, low ceilings, and pictures of these cowboys all around, these weird lights on the walls hanging down everywhere. They took me to my first honky-tonk, which was similar to this, and I just absolutely thought I'd found a paradise, because it's different from, you know, streets. It's different from where I've been. I just hung around out in the streets all the time, and it was different there. Stuff was happening. The music was real loud. The noise in there was real loud. Everybody was hollering and laughing and giggling and screaming or crying or doing something. There was always something going on. And all the guys were over at the bar, and all of us gals were over here waiting for them to get down from the bar and come over where we were. And I just found an exciting place. I just fit in there. I was quiet there, watching to see what you do. That's what I always did, was watch. Outlaws are good watchers. You know, you watch and see what's happening before you make a move. And I discovered when you're out there, the way that they do it, and there is a way to survive no matter where. I mean, you learn here in Al-Anon and AA pretty much, you know, what you're supposed to do and not do. I loved what Stu said last night. It's one of my favorite new lines, when he said that when he was new, the old timers looked him right in the eyeball and talked to him, and he just looked right back in the eyeball. How did he put it? He never backed down from any old timer. I just thought that was the best line I've ever heard. And I didn't back down from anything. Whatever y'all did, I learned and I did it. So I learned about 11-ish that the guys started coming off the stools and coming over where we were, and that they like to dance, and I learned how to dance, and I learned what you do and what you don't do socially at the honky-tonk. Now, the ones that I went to were all Western. I mean, of course, Texas, all country and Western. And at that particular time, I heard it last night, yesterday on the plane, and I just woke straight up. You know, I put those headphones on when I'm on the plane so I can sleep, and I heard this sleepwalk, and I just set straight up, because sleepwalk is my banner. It's what I was under for so long, because usually the last dance at the honky-tonk was sleepwalk, and it's a musical, and I know God sent it. I know it come from heaven. It is music that touches your soul. Ooh, I did it. I touched this thing. I'm not supposed to touch that thing. And it just goes through your bones and your body and your soul, and it's just the most magical thing I've ever heard. I still love that song. Because at midnight, our closing time, they would play that song, and it's one of those honky-tonk songs that you can just gather each other up. Now, Wallace knows exactly what I'm talking about. Because, I mean, you gather each other up. You couldn't put a human hair in between us. I mean, you gather them up, and you are soulmates. And this music is this twangy thing, and it's, your body cannot stand still when you hear it. And it goes something like this, if I can do it. I always hurt people's ears, but it's do. We ought to get that big thing and have an overhead menu ought to dance. And you're just, oh man, I mean, you're just hugged up, and you are tighter than a tick, and you are after it. I mean, do you hear me? I mean, you are after it. And that old guy's right here in my ear, and he's whispering. And he says the things to me that if I'd have an overhead, I could sure tell you what it did, Burns, let me tell you. Alcoholics talk about when they drink what it does to them. It changes everything. And Clancy says, he says this a lot, that when he took a drink, it come down here in his stomach, and it goes boom. And it came back up and spread through his shoulders, and his arms got big, and he got handsome, and he became a man. He could just go whip and beat anything that came his way. And I instantly knew what he was talking about the first time I heard him say that. It was when I was in the middle of the and the guy's right here in this ear, and he says to me, whispers, "Sugar, I need you." Oh, boom, wham, boom, you know, yes, I am woman, I can do it, you know, just, oh, I just get filled up, I'm just, it's magnificent to me. I mean, I'm telling you, it is magnificent to me. It is what I'm born to do. It is what I'm here for. This man needs me. And I can fix anything that's wrong with him. I mean, just like right now. And so I would. Now, I discovered what all of this rubbing up against led to. And I need to tell you that I'm Southern Baptist. In Southern Baptist, you know, dancing, I had already lost it right there. I mean, Southern Baptist, it's the worst to dance. Because they might think you're having fun. I think I hear the story. But I would give up anything. I would give up anything for that feeling, that moment, that night, because I needed what was going on. And what was going on to me was, number one, I had a human touch. Someone was wrapping their arms around me, holding me, touching me, focused directly on me, and said they needed me. Now, my family, when my brother got hurt and I was farmed out, there was nobody that ever touched me. My folks never, I don't ever recall them saying, "Good night, I love you. Good morning, I love you." I don't remember being rocked, hugged, kissed, touched, any form or fashion, ever. So this was something that was really filling me up, and I needed, and I didn't even know it. It was helping me find my place, because I didn't think I had a place anywhere. When he's focused on me like that, I have a place now. So I would give up anything for that, and was quite certain that this was the him for me. He's going to take me off now, and I'm going to be happy. I'm going to have a little picket fence around the house, and I'll have 2.4 children. I'll have a little station wagon with wood on the side of it, and I'm, it's going to be magnificent, because this is the him. He's telling me he needs me. And the next day he sobers up and he's gone. And I'm just devastated. I don't know what happened. So I go back to the honky-tonk company. And he ain't there. But however, at 11-ish, they start falling off that stool and come over there where we are. And about closing time, they play sleepwalk again. And I go through this whole thing. Different guy, different dance. And I did that over and over and over. And nobody made me go out there. Nobody did anything to me. I wasn't a victim. What happened was I got up and I got dressed and I put on my finest, whatever I had, and went out there seeking someone to need me. And I lovingly say, I was just a slut puppy hoe. And that's what I turned out to be, and you can't call it anything else, can you? I mean, that's what it is. It is slut puppy hoe, man. And I drank, and I had a good time, and I got into fist fights, and I just did, I had a lot of fun in those bars. And I knew bar language, I knew bar dress, I knew bar code, I knew everything about the bars. And I met my first major alcoholic out there. Now, the longer you're a slut puppy hoe, the longer you keep going and doing all this stuff, and all the guys know you, and you start knowing the guys, then you have to take moves. You have to go to a different bar. And then you work your way through that bar, and you have to go through another bar and another bar. And I finally wound up at a place called the Bloody Bucket. And it didn't even open up till 4 a.m. And you can just imagine what kind of people I met at the Bloody Bucket. And this was my first major alcoholic. He was a professional gambler, and he was a bootlegger, because my county was dry back then. So he had a lot of money, and I had not seen a lot of money. We were just dirt poor poverty. My dad lost everything when my brother broke his neck and he had to take care of those doctor bills. So I'd never seen any money. And he gave me a $100 bill the first night I met him. And I was just thrilled to death. I had never seen a $100 bill in my life. And I mean, he got my attention. And we started having a meaningful relationship. And we shacked up for quite some time. And I found myself pregnant by this man and not married. And it never occurred to me to say to him, we're going to have a child. We need to get married. We need to take care of this baby. And it never occurred to me to do that, because When you're like I am, and when you know who you are, and when you heard what people call you as you walk by the tables, and when you've been treated the way I am, you know what you are. And there's no negotiating about it. There's no if and it's no secret. You know what you are. I was a piece of garbage. I knew that. I felt it. I lived it. And I didn't expect anything, any treatment other than that. The fact that he was just taking care of me was a major deal. I had this child, a little girl, and at the hospital, he told me that he didn't want me to come back to the house, that he would have things packed up for me, and that he didn't no longer want to take care of me and this baby. He'd done all he was going to do. Well, I have learned through the years. My great-great-grandsponsor came out with this list that she talked about with Al-Anon isms. They talk about alcohol isms, that alcohol is but a symptom of something, and our Al-Anon ism sometimes is a symptom of it. So there's a list that we came up with that kind of describes us. One of them is our need to control, nurturing, I know best syndrome. And then there's one called vindictive. I didn't particularly like that on my list, but that's true. It's there. If you hurt me, I'm going to try to explain to you how much you've hurt me and do something to show you. So I thought he had hurt me, and I'm going to show him how deeply he's done it, show him what he lost. So I started flaunting myself in front of him with another gangster from across town that he didn't like, just deliberately. And I got this man, and I say this, I poured him more whiskey in his drink because, you know, if you're a good Al-Anon, you're the drink mixer. And I poured more whiskey in there than normal and would get him drunk. That's the trick I did for many, many years. More whiskey than normal to get him drunk so I could manipulate like I needed to. And took him over the bloody bucket. And the next day, this man took a shotgun and blew his head off. So that left me with my daughter, her father being a murderer. And how tragic it was, because I never in my wildest dreams ever expected anything like that to happen. Not ever. And I felt so bad. I mean, there's no way to describe it. The next morning after this happened, my friend came, and it was daylight. The sun was coming up, and she came and she told me about this, and I remember this so distinctly. She was standing in the doorway, and the light was coming up behind her, and I could see her silhouette. And she began telling me all this, and then she was getting into the details, and I noticed that everything was going black behind her, and I thought, isn't it strange that the sun's going back down? And the pain was engulfing my neck and my chest and my throat was so intense and so horrific that I decided right then and there, I will not feel this. This is too bad. And so I made a very conscious decision not to feel that emotion. And just like this, the sun came back up, that blackness went away, and I took a step back and took a deep breath, and that was it. And I said, well, that's too bad. And I lived that way for a long, long, long time. A long, long time. There's no way you could hurt me. There's no way you could insult me. There's no way you could do anything to me, because I hid every emotion that I could possibly hide. And it came out as a controlling, raging, mean-spirited, manipulative, untreated Al-Anon's how it came about. I decided that this was so horrific that I needed to change my lifestyle. My parents asked me not to come back to the house, my mother especially. She said, don't tell anybody you're our daughter if they ask. And please don't be coming in out here. I don't want the neighbors seeing you here. And I said, I totally agree, Mama, and I won't, because I understand. She had just been elected to this big office in the Rebecca Lodge, which meant a whole lot to her. And they had asked her to step down from this state office they just elected to her because of me. And I just felt awful because these women, you know, they had a big social thing going on and it was really important to her. I decided to go over to the rodeo grounds. If I got over there, it was in the 60s. And it's when they were burning flags, and cowboys didn't burn flags, and the announcers at the rodeos would say, we don't burn flags, and we stand for the America, and blah, blah, blah. It's exactly like I heard said this morning. I wanted to be decent. I just wanted to be a lady. I wanted to do what I saw other people do. You know, the day that I hated the most was Sunday. I hated Sundays. Because all the families were together on Sundays, and they're out in their yards doing the yard and mowing and doing picnics and just coming in from church. And I just hated it because all the decent people were out on Sundays, and I just stayed in with the blinds just drawn. I just hated it. So I thought, if I go there where the cowboys are, because they're red, white, and blue, all America, you know, that's what I would do, and I'd find a cowboy, and so I did. I went over there and found this cowboy. He was a bull rider, and he was a professional rodeoer, and he came off of a ranch in Spur, Texas, and the family had the ranch, and he was great. He was the best dancer, too. And so I watched him at 11-ish, and chose him. You know, Jim Williams, God bless his soul, used to say that if you put 10 pretty girls upside on the wall, he'd pick the sickest one every time. And I said, Jim, you never have figured out, because when you put those 10 pretty girls against the wall, the sickest one takes one step forward. And I did. I took a step forward and saw him and just went after him and manipulated that till I got this cowboy. And we were dancing and one night and doing whatever we do, and he started poking me in the chest. And there was a great big huge quart empty beer bottle, those brown beer bottles. And I just picked it up and just popped it side his head, which is not the first time I did it, nor the last, but this particular time I did it. And it knocked him to his knees. And I ran out because I figured I'd probably done something that wasn't too smart. And he chased me. And he said, I think you've just knocked some sense into me. I think we should get married. Yeah. Now, I was so thrilled at those words because I never dreamed I'd ever get married. I thought that was something that was for the decent folks. It wasn't going to be for me. So I kept mixing him his salty dogs a little bit stronger, a little bit more manipulative, until a couple days later I had him down at Justice of the Peace. We'd already had our blood work, and before he knew it, that poor soul was married to me. And it was great. I mean, it was wonderful. I know how to be a wife. I know how to do that. I watched. I saw. I listened. And good wives, you know, you do all the things that you're supposed to do. Cook stew. I mean, I'm a great cook, honey. He had chicken fried steak and taters and gravy and homemade biscuits and apple pie when he got home at night. His bath was drawn. I mean, clean clothes were laid out. Doesn't that sound good? I'm telling you. And I mean, he was thrilled to death. I got up in the morning and fixed him pork chops. Had homemade jelly, and he had biscuits, and he had his scrambled eggs, and it was just wonderful. I fixed him his lunch, and I'd write him little notes, put it in, back then we had wax paper, wrap it up in wax paper and put it in his bologna sandwich, so while he'd be eating, you know, he'd get it, pull it out and see a little note of little things I was going to do for him when he got home, and let all the boys think he had the best wife. And I mean, I was great. He was wonderful, and he was happy, and I was happy for the first 6 days. And then old Charlie came by, and off they went, and I got my position at the window, you know, stood there at the window, and waited for him to come home, looking up and down those streets, thinking, golly, what's wrong with me? What is wrong with me? Why does this happen to me? Here, you know, everybody else is home. The pickups are in the street, you know, and the cars are in the drive, the lights are out, the families are tucked in, and here I am in the middle of the night. What's wrong with me? I wish I knew what it was. I wish I knew how to fix it. Maybe I can. And then I started. I just did everything in the world trying to figure out a way to keep him home or go with him or do it. We had a little son and all that madness, and I would do this, and if that didn't work, I'd do that. If that didn't work, I'd go over there and figure out this, and I'd watch you, and I read books, and I formed the kids out one time. This is just the craziest thing. I just saw it on TV just the other day. There was a book called The Joy of Sex. Just come out, and boy, I studied it. It was read by a hooker. I mean, it was written by a hooker, and I thought, well, they've got to know good stuff, because men go to them all the time. So I really want to know what they could do so I could do it and keep him home. This is my whole plan. Aren't our plans great? So I had to farm the kids out, and I wrapped myself in saran wrap, and I had three bows, and I had candles, and everything was ready, and saran wrap is extremely hot, and you cannot sit down in saran wrap. It doesn't bend, and I was miserable. I mean, I was nearly passed out, but I was standing by that door, and I stood by that door, and I stood by that door, and I said, he never came home. And I thought, this is the ultimate. I mean, when you go do this, and they don't come home, this is the ultimate. Just absolutely, I have nothing else to do with him. I packed his bags and put them on the front door. And that began the, you know, the packing in and the unpacking, and me moving out and him moving out, and me going in. And no, I always went exactly where he knew he could find me and stay there a couple of days, and he'd sober up and come get me. And we just played those sick games. And my kids, I hauled them here and I hauled them there, and it was just pitiful. There was violence going on all this time, too. If he didn't come in, I'd throw something at him. When he did come in, I'd throw something at him, or he'd be after me. And I used to go to the bars with him and drink, and we'd both get in trouble. And I quit drinking to stay home and get this family put together, and that didn't work. And I was just a mess. This one particular Thursday, I had two black eyes and a busted lip, which was nothing new. I had that all the time. All my friends had left. I had no friends left. I had no family left. It was just me and this drunk and these two kids. And I absolutely was through. I was at the end of everything. There was nothing left. There was nowhere to go. There was nothing else to say. I'd cried all my tears. I'd screamed all my screaming. I was just quiet. All I was trying to do now is just be quiet. Tell the kids to be quiet. Just let him come in and let him go to bed. Just be quiet. Just don't stir up anything. It was the most miserable existence. And my children were more frightened of me than they were the alcoholic, because if they didn't do these things, then I went after them. This Thursday, I said, I've got to have help. I had read in Ann Landers a few months, an article that this woman had written about a drinking husband, and in my memory, she said, told that woman to call Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what I did. And I talked to whoever, and they gave me this number, and I went up to this woman's house. Come find out, she was a sober member of AA. And she talked with me, and her husband came in, and he talked with me. And they told me things about themselves, and they made arrangements to take me to my first meeting. Now, I just don't think there's any right or wrong. I don't think there's any path that I should take that you should take. I just don't think that. I think we all have divine appointments, because God knows our heart and our soul, that what I can take, you can. What you can, I can. And I just know in my lowest of being that it had to be two AA members that took me to my first meeting. I know that, because I saw their sobriety. I saw their home. It was gorgeous. And she told me how bad they used to live and what their house used to live like. Because that time I was living in a pigsty. Not only was the place the only thing we could afford, but I didn't clean it up. Why should I clean it up? I was too miserable, and it was awful. And I saw sobriety. And that's what hooked me, the sobriety and the hope that these people were talking about. And they took me to my first meeting. And we opened that door, and there was these two guys, and they were leaning up against one of these old-timey cigarette machines that had all the little advertisements on it, and the different lights were in their face. And I'll never forget it, because they were glowing. It looked like they were glowing. And they were laughing out loud and talking to each other, and one hit the other one on the arm. And I remember as they opened that door, I just stopped and I just looked, because I hadn't heard laughter in so long. The sounds of an alcoholic home are so different than that of a normal home or a recovery home. The sounds of an active alcoholic home is usually extremely quiet or extremely loud, screaming, cussing, name-calling. So there was no in-between in my house. So this laughter really got my attention. And in fact, they had to shoo me on inside. And I went in and sat down, and I did not hear what they said. I couldn't tell you what they said probably for the good month. But I saw what they were. They were clean looking, and they were smiling, and they were laughing, and they had, it was an amazing place to me. You know, one of my Al-Anonisms and a lot of others is we have the lack of humor. There's just no sense of humor, you know, anywhere. And when I saw the laughter and the beauty in that room, I was just enthralled, and I was hooked. I mean, I was hooked from the first meeting, didn't know it. And I kept going back, and I would get there right before they said the Serenity Prayer, and I was out of there when they said, "Now we'll say the Lord's Prayer." I was just gone, because I thought, if you know where I come from, I won't be welcome here. And I wanted to be there worse than any place I'd ever seen, because this place had something that I knew that I wanted very, very desperately. And I did this for about 3 months, and it had two doors to this little room. And the alcoholics met in that room, and we met here, and I... knew if I didn't get out before they said the amen, they'd start coming out, and I'd be captured in that coffee room. So I would always sneak out, and they were watching me. I didn't know they were watching me. I didn't know that they knew I was new. How could they tell I was new? I was sneaking in and out. But one of them put their station at this door, and one was at this door. And I chose this door. And my soon-to-be sponsor was standing there waiting on me. And she said a few things to me that only she could have said and only I could have heard, which I know today was a divine appointment. There's no, I just don't debate any of the things that's happened to me. It's what's happened to me, and I don't debate them or excuse them or try to explain them. It was my divine appointment, and she was standing there, and it was just glorious. And the next day she came to where I worked, and she said a few things to me, and I just, you know, I could hear her. I could hear her above everybody else in that room. And I was supposed, looking back, there was 25, 30 maybe people in that room. And I could hear her above them all. Whatever she said, I could hear. So I was really thrilled when I saw her standing there. Somehow or another, I asked her to be my sponsor. And I don't know how I did that because I knew she was too busy. I knew she might say no, and it would be a big embarrassment for me to ask this woman and she say no. But she said yes, of course. And she started taking me through the steps. And I was her first sponsoree. She's got 38 years in this program. And she's still doing the same things that she's always done. She still goes to meetings. She still sponsors people. She's still talking. She's still traveling. She just does everything. So I was absolutely thrilled to death when she would take me on, and she did. She bought me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, we're going to study this so you can see what the disease is. And, of course, she told me to go to open AA meetings so I could hear the alcoholism and the recovery there. And so I did. And then she began to take me through the steps, and I started my road, my path of recovery. And I met God along that way. I had no use for God, no, didn't know anything about God. I knew it was Southern Baptist, and they didn't look like they was having fun, and it just, I didn't believe anything they said. Nothing they said ever worked. When I was a kid, and you know, when things happen to you as a child, a lot of times you keep that decision way up into adulthood. And my brother, when they brought him home one time, he was laying on this mattress in the dining room on the floor. And there'd been a bunch of church people there, and they'd come and they'd prayed over him, and they was poking him, prodding him, seemed like to me, I don't know what they was doing, but there's a bunch of them, and it was loud, and there was a lot of gnashing of teeth, sounded like. And they left, and I went in there, and he said to me, God's going to heal me, and when he does, the first thing I'm going to do is chase you around the backyard. So I went down in the living room and sat down on the couch and waited. Of course, he's paraplegic. He's never going to walk again. And I didn't know that, and I assume he didn't either or had the hope. And I was just waiting, and it never came about. So that just was convinced me that whatever they were saying was not true. And I had a few other experiences like that, so there was no God as far as I was concerned. But these steps, and as it says in the 12th step, I did have a spiritual awakening. For me, it was just right, just enough to open the door, just the right time. And, of course, as the longer I've been in the program, the more I've worked those steps, the more those experiences have grown and had bigger enlightenments. And until today, I know the God of my understanding is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-wisdom, and loves me. I kept going to these meetings, and this cowboy at first was against it and wanted me to stop going and tried to stop me from going. He would physically try to stop me. He would go out and drink every night except the nights I was going, or vice versa. And it just, he did everything. And usually, whatever he said, I did, because I was too frightened at this point not to do anything. And, the physical stuff, when you have been in these kind of raging fights for so many years, pretty soon you have nothing, your spirit's broken. And my spirit was broken. I was terrified of him. Both the gangster and him beat me up a lot. I've been pistol whipped. I've been shot at. I've been thrown out of cars. Top of my ears gone. From being pistol whipped. I mean, I was just mouthy is what I was. And got myself in a lot of trouble. And my spirit just got broken so that I was frightened to do anything at the end there. And for me to go and do this with him saying not to do it was a really big deal. And to go to coffee after the meeting was even a bigger deal, because I knew he was really going to be mad if he came home. And I wasn't there. And these people gently told me, he's going to be mad anyway. And then I said, well, yeah, well, let's just go have coffee. Oh, okay. And it just, it just grew so gently, so tenderly, so easily into recovery. Now, my sponsor is a no-nonsense sponsor. She really wants me to get well and loves me more than I love myself. She has better ideas than I have. She has better visions about my life than I have. And so she laid out a plan of action to me that has always, when I do it, been the best, been the absolute best. I do not argue with anything and never have argued with anything that she's told me to do. I just do it. doesn't mean that in my mind thinks she was a little nuts, but I did it. And has led me on a path of recovery that it has been just so fabulous, I can't even tell you. So when she said, come go have coffee, I would. She'd say, come get in the car. We're going to a conference this weekend. Find somewhere for your kids. And I'd do that. I'd go off to conferences. And then she'd say, come over here. We're going to have a book study. And I'd go over there and do a book study. I mean, just little by little by little. And I started growing up in this fellowship and started doing things. And I got a sponsoree. Gosh, my first sponsoree almost killed her. You know, I said, get up and call me. You may not need to go to the bathroom, so call me first. You know, I just didn't know what to do, so I wanted her to tell me everything she was going to do. And she's still going today, so I guess she's okay. And after I'd been around here for about 6-8 months, the cowboy decided that he'd tried. So he came in and he got sober, and he stayed sober for 6 months. And then we went to a conference and we heard some speakers, and one of them I still know today, and I tease him, it's his fault my cowboy went and got drunk. So he came and he heard him talk, and then when we got home he went and got drunk and drank for the next 26 years. I stayed with him for 7 years in the program, in the fellowship, him still continuing drinking and me continuing in recovery. At the end of that 7 years, one night, he came in, and when he came in, I knew that I was in trouble. He had that wild look, you know, that they get when they're in blackouts. I knew he was in a blackout, and he was just wild looking. And the minute I walked in this door, the violence stopped. Two reasons. One of the guys told me, why don't you try keeping your mouth shut, which I did. And the other is, I think God stepped in and started protecting me. Because the violence stopped the instant I walked in this door, and for 7 years there hadn't been any, and it was pretty much on a regular basis. And this particular night, he came in this blackout, and he started screaming at me and started beating me up, and I was trying to crawl away from him. It's all tied up in the sheets, and I got to the foot of the bed, and I fell. And when I fell, my head hit the carpet, and it just kind of bounced up like this. And when it bounced up, I looked in the door, and there was my two children. Now, this hadn't taken 15, 20 seconds, 30 seconds max. I mean, he would just boom, bam, I'm screaming and trying to get out. My kids, from clear at the other end of the house, heard that, come in there, and was standing there. And I thought, my God, look at these kids. How quick they got in here. Weren't they asleep? It's in the middle of the night. And they were screaming, begging, Daddy, please don't hit her anymore. Please don't hit her anymore. And I, for the very first time ever, I heard and I saw my children. Now, that's the God's honest truth. Prior to that, I put the kids in the back bedroom. I didn't think they saw, felt, heard, or anything. I just didn't think they saw the disease because I kept them in their room all the time, God love them. And I saw their faces. And the stark, absolute terror on my son's face is something I will never forget, the look on his face. Just screwed and just agony and pain, and my daughter screaming. It was such an awesome insight to me that I thought, this is it. We got to get out of here. I got to get these kids out of here. And so I left. Now, I'm a high school dropout. I have no education, and I have these two children. That's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons I stayed for so long. You know, they ask us, Al-Anons, why don't you leave? Well, I don't know why I'm not going to leave. I don't know. If I could tell you that, that would be wonderful, but I don't know. I'm going to as soon as the kids get out of school, I'm going to leave. As soon as I get some money saved, I'm going to leave. As soon as I get the car paid off, I'm going to leave. As soon as. I've heard the same thing from these podiums. Why do you quit drinking? I don't know. But as soon as, I'm going to, you know. As soon as. So it's just the disease as far as I've been able to tell. And I knew that I had to get out there. There was absolutely no ifs, no ands, no buts. I had to get out of there. And by this time, I knew that God probably would take care of me. And I just made that surrender. And sure enough, I had people to stay with. I had a car next thing I knew. I had an apartment next thing I knew. Next thing I knew, I was enrolled in nursing school. It was nothing I ever wanted to do. My sponsor was a nurse, and she had told me about her nursing career. And I mean, it was just amazing. Somebody came up and offered me a way to get Texas Rehab. Wrote out the papers, handed it to me, said, here, let me do this for you. Another guy in the group says, you know, I work for the welfare department. Come down tomorrow. Let me get you signed up, and you get some aid for these kids. Another guy says, why don't you go to church, and we'll help you at the church. I had started going back to this church where a lot of the AAs were going at the time. So they set this thing up, a whole bunch of them, to sign for some money for me. So I had money, and I had Texas Rehab that got me in nursing school. I had Texas Aid to Children that helped me with finances, and I was in school. I graduated. And when we graduated, my class asked me to give the class response, which was a really big deal. And that night, I never forget it. I was all in my white uniform. We had a little white, we were capped. We had little white hats back then that you wore a hat. Well, I sound like I'm old, don't I? Back then. And this whole, it was about 400, 500, 600 people, this big, huge church. And right over here, all this front section was my AA people. Everybody just crammed in there just, you know, supporting me. It was just so really neat. And my parents were there. And I remember they were in the middle of that section, and I was giving the class response, and I was thanking the families for standing by us because it was a really hard, long, intense schooling. And I looked at my parents and said, I want to thank the families. And my dad was crying, and the neighbors had come with him, and he was poking my neighbor, and he said, that's my kid. I could read his lips. And I was just, sorry. I was so overwhelmed at that very moment because, you know, they... My parents forgave me. They didn't do anything. I did it all. I did the steps. I went to see them, and it wasn't easy getting back in there. My mama's good graces, but I did exactly what my sponsor did, and I went over there once a week and brought a card, and then I stopped by and bring a flower and tell them how I was okay. And it was a long, tedious struggle, but they did forgive me, and there they were supporting me and so thrilled. You know, I believe in full circles in this fellowship, too. I think God gives us a way to make amends in a living situation, when we're ready and willing, he just gives us these full circles. And one of the full circles was I was able to help the man who gave me Texas Rehab. I was able to help him when he was dying. The woman who helped me with the aid, I got to help her. Another guy was dying, I got to help him. And eventually my father got cancer and he was dying. I was the first one there to take care of him and guide him through that process. And my whole family was looking to me to help with that, and it was like paying them back for a lot of the pain and the embarrassment and the humiliation that I put them through. They were asking me to help, and it was a full circle for me. My father did die, and it was a great experience. When I got pregnant with my daughter, my next oldest brother, my hero, the one that I loved the most, quit speaking to me, and he did not have anything to do with me. But when my dad died, he came to me. It was the first time he had spoken to me in many, many years. His children were not allowed to be around my children very often. And he said, would you like for me to go get your kids out of school and tell them about Daddy? And I said, please. And it was the kindest act he ever did for me. And he went and got the kids and told them and brought them home. And it was the only time in 26 years that he was tender to my children or tender towards me. Because a few years after that, he was drunk. Then I realized why he was my favorite. He was an alcoholic. He was drunk and he killed himself. And in all that time, the one kindness was because of the act of my father's death, that seemingly bad thing. At least we had that few moments, and those are really precious to me, and they're really precious to my children. I was self-supporting by my own contributions. I loved it. I went to work and it was just great, and things were going tricking along, and my daughter started acting funny and doing funny. You know, they say that only an alcoholic can diagnose themselves as an alcoholic. I've also heard from the same podiums that if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and waddles like a duck, chances are it's a duck. And she was doing a lot of waddling and a lot of quacking. And sure enough, it just amazed me, you know, the statistics of who and what's going to become an alcoholic. Of course she was an alcoholic. And it's, the cowboy had raised her. That's what she saw in her... real father was an alcoholic, so she didn't have much of a chance there. And got into a lot of trouble, and we got into a lot of trouble. I got where I couldn't tolerate my daughter. She was just too much pain for me, and I was too much pain for her, and we just kind of split her, and she had her road to go, and I was just devastated by it, because I'd heard enough sober alcoholic women talk to know that we were in real trouble, and I just didn't want to hear or know about her alcoholism. It was just too much for me. My son was 11 years old. They called him from school. They found him sniffing Pam, you know, that you spray and cook with, through a paper towel holder. For pity's sakes, Pam. I thought, what the? And I noticed his little boyfriend down the street kept coming borrowing Pam. I thought, boy, his mother must be really broke and cook a lot, you know, and there's always borrowing Pam for me. So I went and got him to school, took him to the doctor, went through all that, got him back home, and I said, son, why in the world did you do that? And he said to me, Mama, I like the way it makes me feel. Well, I knew I was in trouble. I'd heard that too many times from these podiums. And so I was going to put him in a boys' ranch. A lot of the alcoholic men were helping me, and I was going to save him from this disease. And his still drunk cowboy daddy found out about it and come kidnapped him and took him off, and he hadn't lived with me since. And he's 36 years old today, I think. No, 32. And I'll tell you, I just felt both my children were so ingrates after all I had done for them. After all I had done for them. And both of them, off they went. I went to my sponsor, and I absolutely, it's one of those times you just want to check out. You know, I am so miserable. My children don't even want to be around me. The men don't want to be around me. You know, what is wrong with me? What's the deal that this keeps happening in my life? And she told me to take an inventory on my motherhood, which I did. And I discovered that I did a lot of things wrong. I also discovered I did a lot of things right. And what I discovered that our family was dealing with was alcoholism and Al-Anonism. And there is absolutely no blame. It just is. And that God has no grandchildren. And that He loved those kids much more than I'd ever comprehend. And that they, if I could turn them over to God and mind my business today, Saturday, then I had a chance of survival. She told me to go somewhere in my prayer and meditation and literally offer these kids up. And so I remembered a time when we were all at church. And at my church, if you needed to, you could come down to a kneeling rail at the end of the service, and the pastors, the elders, would come and pray with you for whatever particular need you had. And I remember one Sunday, my son had tucked me on, pulled my little shirt, and asked me if we could go down there and pray for his daddy. And so we all, three of us, went down there and prayed. And I remembered the feeling. There was lights much like these, and they were down on our shoulders. It was really warm, and my kids, we all held hands, and we prayed for their daddy. So this day that I was having to leave them somewhere in my mental mind and prayer and meditation, I chose this memory. And we prayed, and I put their hands together, and I got up and backed off and left my children at that kneeling rail in God's hands. And I knew that that was all right. Now, what that did was it took away the worry, because I really left from God. It did not ever take away my concern, but it took away my worry for these kids. And they flourished and went on and did what they needed to do. So here I am, single and having a good time. I was really not going to be a slut puppy hole this trip out, and I wasn't. Got some dignity and some self-worth, and really tried to do it the right way. And I met a man who was sober a long time in the program, and we dated long distance. He had the biggest blue eyes and the biggest old gruffy voice and big old plumber, short, fat plumber. I always liked these big, tall, exotic, good-looking guys, and I got my little short, fat plumber, and he was just the cutest thing you've ever seen. And we dated for a while, and I was going to move out to California. He lived in California. Clancy was his sponsor. And at the very last minute, I packed up everything I owned, gave away all my furniture, just my little stuff that I really wanted to keep, you know, my stuff. Had it in a U-Haul trailer, and Monday morning my friend was going to drive me out. I took off Friday to go tell everybody how great the program was, and came back Sunday, and he met me in Lubbock. He met me, had flown in. I thought, oh, isn't that sweet? He's going to drive me out. He can't wait to be with me. And he said he hadn't gotten in touch with his feelings, and that he could not have me come out, that he just wasn't ready for a commitment, and went on off. And he used to make me say all the time, Ad, tell him what I did. He gave me a big wad of money to get myself put back together. He's dead now. I shouldn't tell it. Should have make him just look like a jerk. But he gave me a big wad of money. I put everything back together, and I was so angry. I wasn't angry at Jim. I was angry at life. I was angry at God. You know, what's the deal? I'd done everything y'all said do here. I'd done everything. I'd been sponsored. I'd done all that service crap and the boring service meetings. And I'd done everything he asked me to do. And here it is. I'm, you know, a long time in this program. What's the deal? It's just a bunch of crap. You're all brainwashing each other. It's just a bunch of crap. And I've been here long enough to know in a room this size with this many people, there's somebody here today who feel the same way I do, and you had a lot of time. And what do you do with that when you've got a lot of time? You know, you're not supposed to go around and say you're a piece of crap. And I was just so angry that what I chose to do, and I do not know why I chose to do this, just what I did. I started 13-stepping some new guys who were like 20 minutes sober, just getting at them, getting at men, getting at God. This way you gonna treat me? Let me show you how to trick or two. And I didn't mess with one. I was messing with three at the same time, which I would, and let me tell you, I would not ever tell this if my sponsor didn't make me. It makes me look trashy, and I was, and I don't, and I'm not proud of it, and it's one of those horror things I wish I could take an eraser and just erase out of my life, but it's what happened, and it is a fact. I learned from that, and she made me go tell Jack when she finally found out. One of them snitched on me. He was a slipper, and he knew her, and so he called and snitched on me, which still makes me mad. And she made me go talk to her husband, who was Jack, who I had rather take a potato peeler and just peel my skin off than go tell Jack what I was doing. Jack later. And so I went and told him, and he looked at me with complete disdain, and he loved me. I mean, he was the first man who ever loved me without anything except just pure, absolute love and wanting the best for me. And I had disappointed him, and I'll tell you, that just almost, it was worse than anything he could have said or done to me, just that look on his face. And he said, you know, we don't do that here, tall gal. He had a nickname for everybody. He said, we don't do that here. He said, if you got to do that, go outside this program, because we deal in people's lives here, and that's not what we do, and you can't do that here. And it was such a lesson in my being that I don't want to disrespect this fellowship in any way, fashion, or form, and that there are lives saved here. And I don't want to be one that causes anything, anybody, to ever walk out that door. And I had a lot of forgiving to do of myself, a lot. And we went to a conference right after that, and I didn't think I was going to be able to stay. And I said the one thing to my sponsor that I've been hiding all this time, you know, that take it to the grave stuff? And I told her this one night about 2 a.m. at Lake Brownwood at the Lakeside Conference under those big old trees. I said to her, I know what it is, Pat. I didn't want to ever say it out loud, but I know what it is. And I don't know why it is, but I am unlovable. And I don't know why. I'm just unlovable. And if I could change that, I would. But I just don't know how, and I don't know why. What's wrong? And she said, oh, Vinoy, that's not so. She said, because I love you. I love you just the way you are. I'm mad at you, but I love you. And she reached over and she grabbed me and pulled me over her lap, and she did what was done for you, Burns. She rocked me. I mean, she literally rocked me. My sponsor's this little bitty tiny thing, so small. And she rocked me, and she said, and if I can love you the way I do, just imagine how much God loves you. And for whatever reason, that particular night on that particular blanket under those particular stars, I heard what she said. And that particular night, I got a connection with God that I had never had, that he loved me just the way I was. It never occurred to me that he did that, because I always thought you had to work the steps and get good before you could reach the throne. And I went through the steps right after that, and that's the first time I'd ever noticed in the seventh step prayer, it says, God, the good and the bad of me. And I thought, God, it was a new concept, that he knows my heart, and he knows all that bad stuff, and he loves me anyway. It was just, and it changed my life. That seemingly really bad thing, we were talking about May 4th, if you didn't read May 4th in One Day at a Time book, I really invite you to do that. It was just awesome. They just put that page in there just the other day. And I went back, driving back, and I remember telling God, you know, if you would just let me come back, if you will forgive me for being so disloyal to you and to this fellowship that saved my life, I will do whatever's asked, you know. I'll just, please just let me stay here, and please just let me do. And I'll tell you, I went back and I started cleaning those ashtrays again. I had gotten above it. I was having the little sponsorees, you go do that while I stay here and be the queen. And I went back and started setting up chairs. I set up chairs today. I'm the leader heater host right now in my group. I have a commitment every time there's a commitment, and I had to go tell my sponsors what was happening and change my life. And about that time, which was, it took a good year or two, Jim came back in my life, and he had done what he had to do in those 2 years. And I'm convinced if God has you a divine appointment with a man, it's going to happen, and there's not anything you can do to prevent it. And if it's not a divine appointment, there's not anything you can do to make it happen. So it's so easy for me to relax about that. That the hen and she and we do, God, it's in God's hands. We don't really have to worry about it. Except if you're single, yeah, don't worry about it. And he came back and we did get married. And we had a great marriage, you know, for about 6 days. I thought if you're sober, everything's going to be fine. But it never occurred to me that sobriety is alcoholism too. And that sobriety is Al-Anonism too. So we really had to hammer out a marriage. And it was not a pretty sight for a long, long time. His 2 kids and my 2 kids came together. He had 2 alcoholic kids. I had 2 alcoholic kids. And it was really something. My daughter called me. She had tried to commit suicide drunk. I didn't go. I didn't rescue her. I said, well, you just got to do whatever you got to do, and loved her from afar. His daughter called him. She had a child out of wedlock like I had had and said she's going to put him in adoption, adopt the baby out because that's in a foster home. That's all she knew to do. That's the way she had been raised. Jim was an alcoholic. Her mother was an alcoholic. Mother died drunk. And I said, let's send for her and that baby. And that's Sheila. Many of you know Sheila. And so we sent for her, and she was, oh, my goodness, she was just my spiritual soul daughter. I'll tell you, I just adore that child. And the grandson became mine. We helped take care of that kid. And she has 16 and a half years sober now. She came back into Oklahoma where we were living at the time and found her way. She's remarried and got a little boy, another little boy, and she's doing extremely well. My daughter, I went back to Lubbock all the time after we married to the yearly little get-together like this because it was like my homecoming. And she came to hear the speakers just come to be with me for one Saturday night. She heard her story and she got sober. And the boys are still out there doing what they do. Jim and I moved to California. We went broke. He had a lot of money when I first married him. It was so exciting. And then he went broke. And Clancy made him come back out to California. Didn't make him. Suggested that he'd come back there. And am I through? I have no idea when we started. I'm so confused.
You're fine.
Okay, I'm almost done if your butt's tired. I mean, boy, that was not. I'm almost through. So we moved back to California, and while we were there, my daughter called, and she was pregnant and not married, and then she got married, and then she had baby, and then she got divorced, and then she came to where we were in California, so we had another grandchild. And I tell you, it was so much fun. I think nearly everybody's mentioned their grandchildren. You know, I was a lousy mother, Jim was a lousy dad, and God gave us this full circle opportunity of being able to take care of these grandbabies and see my big old gruff husband go down to kindergarten and carve out pumpkins for the little children was just about the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And see him put on the Santa Claus suit and go down to the first graders and play Santa Claus was incredible. And he absolutely loved every bit of it. And it was so much fun to watch him be a grandpa. And we were doing really great. My brother killed himself right after we got out there, and I went back for that, and his daughter came up to me, and she had a drinking problem. And on my daughter's one-year AA birthday, my two daughters 12-stepped my brother's daughter, and she's been in and out of the program now all this time, but I thought how ironic that after he died that my kids was trying to save his kid, and he hadn't spoken to his daughter in 20-something years. He was a very hard man, and his little daughter was dying of the disease, and my two kids are helped saving her life. And so there's another full circle, really grand. We were out in California doing great, and Jim got sick, and his shoulder began hurting him, and we took him in, and 3 months later he was diagnosed with cancer, and he died. And it'll be five years in about 3 weeks. And it was such a shock, number one, for him to be sick, but... And they were so gracious to tell us the truth. We begged for the truth, and they told us he didn't have much time. So everybody came from all over the country, and we just had such... he went out with such fun. It was a tragedy, but he had such fun, and the guys were coming, and he was a golfer, and we had a place out in Palm Springs at the time, and they'd sneak him out the back door, and I'd look up, and they'd have him on his golf cart and his big oxygen tank and all this stuff, and they'd be hiding him, you know, like I couldn't see him. And it was a lot of fun watching them help him leave this planet. And I was crying one night, and he got up in the middle of the night, and he came in there, and he said, why are you crying? And I said, I'm just going to miss you so much. I was just bawling. He said, well, you want me to figure out a way to take you with me? I said, no, I'm not going to miss you that much. And at the end of that, we had bought this place, and it was paid for at Palm Springs, and the business was in California. And at the very end of that, when we was trying to get all this put together to take care of all the finances, and we discovered we'd been embezzled, and there was absolutely no money. And my husband had to go out suffering this, and that's the only regret that he had and that I have is watching my husband's face worry about me. And those last few days I crawled up in bed with him, I just lied like a toad. Boy, I mean, I told him that we'd found this and somebody had was buying the company and everything was great. He didn't have to worry about me. And he smiled. It was the last smile that he had. And I lied to him, and I thank God blessed that lie because he went out okay. And I lost everything. I had to go to detectives and police and lawyers and attorneys, and it was just all gone. Lost my home, lost everything, and I moved into this little room and back in L.A. And a few months later, my little nephew was crushed to death on an oil rig in Houston. He was drunk. So we had to go tend to that. And then a few months later, that my stepdad of 20 years died. And a few months after that, my mother died. So I had four deaths in 11 months, and it was just like, you know, I didn't know which emotion to do. And we closed down my mother's house and walked off. She had been in that house 47 years, and in 2 weeks, she was dead, buried, and the house was empty. And we walked off, and there was a for sale sign. And I got back to California, and I mean, I was just really reeling. Just, it was just nuts. And as I've heard said over and over this weekend, and it's true, you know, life goes on. Because we're here does not mean life doesn't go on. But the most incredible thing is, when one of us is wounded, how people come. They just come. It is the most magnificent thing. I'm wounded and I'm straggling, and the people I sponsor are on both sides of me, holding me up and walking me down that path because I can't walk by myself. And I just love you so much that it's unspeakable. It's just unspeakable because, you know, when I can't fly, y'all fly for me. And I got in this little room, and then when I could get out of this little room, it just finally dawned on me that when I could get out of this room, this couple came up to me and they said, you know, we know that you help a lot of hearts, and we would tithe. We tithe the American Heart Association and places like that, and we decided that you save as many hearts as the American Association does, so we want to tithe to you, and we're going to give you an apartment for a year. And so I had a paid-for apartment for a year, and it was just great. At the end of the year came up just a few months ago, and I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I know God has a plan. I mean, I just knew it, and I just did not worry about it. Well, just in December, it was up. In December, I was notified that my company was folding and that the home company in Chicago was taking over us. And about that same time, my friend was moving out of a house that our friend is living in New York. This is her house. She wants it for her retirement. She wants people in it that she can trust, so she just gives it to you dirt cheap. So Reed was moving out and said, do you want to move in? And I said, oh, yes. And so I moved in. Now, I didn't have quite enough money to take care of this house, but I just knew it was right. It just felt right. I moved in December and then went to this meeting, and I got more money, better plan, everything. It was exact money I needed for this little house. I mean, God is so good. I didn't need it till it was time to need it, you know. I am so taken care of. It's just totally amazing. My girls gave me a lot of money. On my 30th birthday, I was not in any place to have a big party, so they gave me a bunch of money and put it away. And last January, this cowboy husband of mine, he had 4 years sober. And it's just amazing. My daughter had a slip. When she had 10 years sobriety, she had come out with the kid. She had 10 years of sobriety and tried to commit suicide sober. Doing all the things, it's amazing how the light goes away when you're doing all the things. And she had depression and sober. And we put her in treatment and found out what was going on with her. I'll tell you, when they take their life, they just take their life, and there's not anything you can do about it. I knew I could not live with that. I could not have that hanging over my head, and I just gave her to God. You know, I can't live every day with her stomping her toe and me feeling bad about it, so I had to really give her up. She had 30 days sober, and my son called me, and his dad, the cowboy, had been drunk, put his hand through some machinery, and just nearly died, and he was in a hospital. And the guy who put him in the hospital said, I'm not taking care of him. Y'all have to come get him. You have to do whatever you have to do. So Jim gave my daughter a ticket back to Lubbock, and he said, go take care of your dad. So she went back there, and she 12-stepped him with all of 90 days, and he got sober, full circle. And January, he had 4 years, and he just dropped dead. He never made any amends to me. No. His sponsor is a really good old friend of mine, and I said that to him. He said, hell, you wasn't even on the list. But But there was no money to bury this cowboy, and the people who had given me this money for my 30-year party, I thought, they won't mind. And I took some of that money and took it back and buried this cowboy. And he had the cutest funeral you've ever seen. We got an old pine box. It was a 100-year-old antique box that they donated to us. We went and got Bella Hay, and I got ropes and his cowboy boots and his big book and his hat and his spurs. And it was the cutest funeral. Everybody was saying it. These guys coming up, when you do my funeral? And I may have a new profession. I don't know. And the three of us were standing at his graveside, and my son looked at me and he said, "Mom, I love you." And my daughter said the same thing. And it was like that warm sun, and here we were. And I had my two kids' hands, and I said, "Oh, thank you, God. You know, you've really done full circles. We have buried this man, and it's in recovery, and I'm so grateful." There was a man in my part of the country named Bob White. He was just an icon. He treated us all with such dignity and taught us so many things. And one of the things that he said at one of his last talks, Jim and I started a conference in Oklahoma called the Canyon Conference, and he was one of the first speakers, the first Sunday morning speaker. And right after that, he got cancer, and I was able to full circle go and help take care of him. And he said this that Sunday. He said, "We close our meetings with the Lord's Prayer. And it says in there, 'Our Father.' And then it says, 'The kingdom, the power, and the glory forever.' If there is a kingdom, and if it's our Father, that means that he's our daddy. He's the king. That makes me and you a prince and a princess of the kingdom." He said, "So act like it. Claim your heritage. Hold your head up and be a princess. And share that with other people. And treat each other like your royalty. Because you are. And the power is in these meetings, in these rooms. And when we touch each other and hug each other and help each other and give our experience and our strength and our hope in the glory, the kingdom, the power, and the glory. The glory is God himself. How he just, I mean, we are so shined. We are so beautiful. We are so polished. We are so loved. And it's all because I was a slut puppy hoe. That doesn't make sense to me. Thank you for my heritage. Thank you for my life. I love you very much. Thank you."